We're joined in this portion of our program, The Fan, by Andrew Lieb. Andrew is managing attorney of Lieb at Law PC, as a practice focus on litigation and regulatory compliance. He's also the author of book 10 Strategies to Purchase Property Post-Pandemic, The Ultimate Guide to Real Estate Investing. It's an interesting idea, an interesting title for a book too. He's also, as I understand, a diehard Islanders fan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Nice to have you join us on our program.
Bob, thank you so much for having me on. And I appreciate the plug to my Islanders more than anything else, because this is the year we're going to the Cup.
There you go. I always like to do a little bit of background with folks who join us in discussion. For you, you practice some interesting areas of law. What got you interested in this field of becoming an attorney in the first place?
Well, I'm a competitive guy, Bob, just like they are in hockey or any other sport, football. And I don't have the natural talent to do anything besides beer league sports. But when it comes to brain fighting, I'm really good at it. And I like to win. And you see, when you're a litigator, whether you're doing landlord-tenant, foreclosure, brokerage litigation, discrimination, it's all about having a strategic knowledge edge. And if you can study a little harder, work a little more, have a little more grit, you'll win. And I like winning, Bob.
What advice do you give to young people who are in law school these days about the career opportunities that there are?
So we have a bunch of externs that work for us in our firm every year. It's usually between 1 and 3. And I'm going to tell you what I tell them. Be prepared for your worldview to change. And what I mean by that is that they go in with a thought of, I want to help society. I want to help people. And don't misunderstand, that's great. But they go out with understanding nuance and that every issue isn't so simple. And there isn't a simple listen to Fox News or MSNBC and have an opinion. Everything has a reason and there's pros and cons in everything. So I think the big thing for them to do is to be ready to transform the way they look at issues.
You mentioned the term discrimination a couple of minutes ago. One of the things I understand in your practice is you do some work in the area of discrimination prevention training. What has that been like?
Yeah, so that's probably the biggest aspect of our practice is discrimination litigation and trainings. And what it's like is it starts off in New York State. Every employer is required to train every employee on sexual harassment prevention. And so we broaden it into race and religion and disability and all sorts of other important topics, because there's twofold. Number one, you have a better workforce if it's more inclusive and more people feel like they're having equity and they're involved in being benefited. That's one side. And then on this other side, an employee that's aggrieved and has been discriminated against can put you out of business. So an employer needs to say to themselves, I want to do it because it's right and it's better for work, but I better do it because if I don't do it, the laws are against me and I'm going to get sued. Because, you know, with discrimination law, most people do things through what's called implicit bias. They don't even realize they're discriminating and they can be liable for that as well.
What sort of things do you see?
It's a great thing. The biggest one that we deal with is with disability. Someone has a disability that doesn't let them do the actual job that they were hired to do. And they ask for what's called an accommodation. And you can't just say no because you don't want to let them have an opportunity. As long as it doesn't create what's called an undue hardship for your business, and someone has a documented disability, you have to go through this legal mumbo jumbo called the interactive process. And in plain English, you have to say, maybe there's a way I can help you out. The simplest way is our president is now requiring, I don't know if you saw, OSHA is going to be putting out regulations that say everyone in 100 person plus businesses need to get vaccinated. Well, if you're disabled and you can't get vaccinated, the question becomes, what is a way that you can still participate in your job because you're disabled, and continue to do that without getting vaccinated. And an example of an accommodation would be saying, just like they did in the Indiana University case, where Indiana University required all students to get vaccinated, which went up to the Supreme Court, is to say, hey, wear a mask and get tested twice a week. That's a good accommodation if you can't get vaccinated based on the fact that you have this health condition.
And one of the things that is coming up, because this is obviously a very hot issue right now, is when the statement is made that, you know, somebody who's unvaccinated needs to get tested once a week or twice a week or whatever. One of the issues that comes up is, okay, who pays for those tests?
A terrific question that you asked. What I would say to an employer, because that's who I generally represent in these things, although we do represent employees, is to the extent that it's not a financial burden, pay for it. There's no reason why you wouldn't want to pay for it and try and make it worthwhile for your employee. Why? Because let's set aside the law for one second, Bob, and let's say to ourselves, when you start nickel and diming your employees quit. I am an employer, and we have lunch a few times a week. We have yogurts in our refrigerator. We have drinks all over the place. If there's a way as an employer you can show your employee that they're valued and that you're not just henpecking them and making them lose on all turns, you better do that. And when you look at the cost of having an employee paying for a test here, there, or everywhere, assuming their health insurance doesn't cover it, is the right thing to do anyway.
And then the other aspect of this, because we're hearing so often, you know, the message behind those signs we're seeing everywhere of help wanted, okay? I mean, it's unbelievable how many signs like that you see in the course of a day. Employers are having a tough enough time just trying to attract people.
Correct.
To jobs, okay? And you would think they would not want to put further impediments in the way of people continuing in the job.
I can only tell you in my own job, Bob, the minute COVID stuff happened, we have masks everywhere for people. Take them home, bring them to your family. We have Purell everywhere. Take them home, bring them to your family. We're trying to make a solution for people. And when you look at line items, it's a nothing line item for compared to having an employee or getting sued. So one of the things is, we can get into the legality of, do you have to pay for it? Do you don't? And I don't really want to go there, because I want to say to you that the cost of defending the lawsuit is so much more than being right. And my mother taught me, Bob, being right isn't everything.
For people who are listening to our discussion today, they themselves, or perhaps they witness, they observe discrimination in the workplace. Can they do? What should they do?
I love your question. And I'm going to tell you why I love your question. It ties into your prior question. And you asked about prevention training. Mm-hmm. And I have an interesting background. I'm not just an attorney, but I worked in the public health field. I have a master's in public health. And I want to combine those two in my answer to you. If you train people not to discriminate, public health people have taught us on their peer-reviewed articles that there's actually an uptick in discrimination after the training. But if, Bob, you instead teach people to intervene when they watch others discriminating, you find that there's a downtick in discrimination. That's the most effective way to end discrimination. To teach others, don't say you're the bad guy, you're the bad girl, but instead said you could be part of the solution. So I think the number one thing we should do is say, you know what? Always try and be part of the solution. Now, when I say that, I want to point out, some people don't want to be a martyr. Some people would rather get discriminated against than have the scene and have to be present and make a big deal about it. So you have to be conscious of what the victim wants as well. But it's good to go to the victim. It's good to say, I'm here to help you. Here's how we go to HR. Here's how we make a complaint. It's good to say to the person that was the assailant, the wrongdoer, to say, I know you didn't intend to do that, but here's how you could have hurt someone. It's nice to be nice. And if you have a chance to change your behavior because you are unintentionally hurting someone else, why wouldn't you want to do that? I would think that it would be insane to live your day and say, I'm hurting someone. It does nothing for me to stop hurting someone, but I'm going to do that because I like the right to hurt people. Who wants to live like that? Not me. I'll tell you that much.
One of the other areas of talk about discrimination that I wanted to go into is to touch upon discrimination in real estate, in housing discrimination. Let's start first with real estate. What is considered discrimination in real estate?
So you're hitting my big fields right now. We do discrimination in three main fields. There's a fourth, but we do less of it. We do it in employment, like you said a second ago. Mm-hmm. We do it in, you're differentiating between real estate and housing, and I'm going to differentiate between what's called public accommodations and housing. So that's the technical term. Okay. So a public accommodation would mean any commercial business, public space that you visit, a movie theater, a diner, a motel. In all those places, you have a right to be there, and you have certain protections under the Civil Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act to not feel like you're being denied in a multitude of facets. First of all, by signage, by advertisements, by statements. Another way is in the terms, conditions, or privileges of being there. Another way still yet is that if you need an accommodation because of your disability, as you and I touched on before. So we mentioned first employment, then we mentioned accommodations, which you called real estate. And then the last one is housing, the Fair Housing Act. And the Fair Housing Act has the broadest of all the protections of all the laws, in my opinion. And when I say the Fair Housing Act, you got to remember that there's county laws, there's town laws, there's village laws, there's state laws. In New York State, where I am, Bob, and New York City, the housing laws are so protective that you really shouldn't be saying, who are you? I want to know about you. You should be saying, who's making the best offer? That's who should live there.
Hmm. As you're talking, I'm thinking about this whole idea of public accommodation. Think about the situation where you see somebody who has a physical disability and they're in need of, with an assistive device, using a ramp.
Yes.
To access. I am always amazed, considering how long ago it was that the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed and signed into law, how many places don't have, clearly do not have, a way for somebody who's physically disabled, needs that access in that fashion, to get in the door. Lots of businesses, it seems, don't. I mean, isn't that just counterintuitive?
Well, let's drop the law for a second. It's counterintuitive for a business not to want a patron to come in the door. I agree with you. Right. Setting aside the whole law, I prefer to have my customers come in as opposed to walk to my competitor.
Right.
But to the technicality of the law is that when you do not do a renovation, and there's specific types of renovations of a pre-existing building, there's not always requirements that you have to create the access you and I are talking about. The government gives us in the regulations for the Americans with Disabilities Act how you're supposed to remove barriers to entry. The whole thing is about accessibility.
Right.
So I think you're 100% on point, but it depends on what the barrier is at that door in the first place. Now, what I would suggest to you that in housing, which is even more interesting, just to go to another side, if it's your house, there was a case that went all the way up to New York's highest court about 4 or 5 years ago. And a lady said, I'm in a wheelchair and I need a wider door jamb to get my wheelchair outside the door. That makes sense, right? Like, I want to leave my apartment. I'd rather not be a prisoner in my own house. And the place said, oh, no, 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 we can't do it. It's going to make us shut down the building. It was a high rise. It's going to make us shut down the building for a bunch of days. And you know what else? It's going to make us have to evict a few people for a little while we do the construction. And this went all the way up to the highest court. And what happened was their experts said, while it's going to be very hard, it's theoretically possible. And what New York's highest court basically said is, if it's theoretically possible, you have to give the disabled person the accommodation and housing. That's how broad the strength is in housing as opposed to public accommodation. It's slightly different again because of the fields we're in.
Kind of amazing when you stop and think about it too. Wow. We're talking with Andrew Lieb on our program, and interesting discussion. I mentioned the author of the book, 10 Strategies to Purchase Property Post-Pandemic, The Ultimate Guide to Real Estate Investing. We'll get into talking about that. He's a diehard Islanders fan. He's managing attorney of Lieb at Law PC, and he is our guest in this portion of our program. Now, let's talk a little bit about the book. Why did you do the book?
I don't know if you can remember back a year and a half ago. It feels like it's been a decade, maybe two, since this happened at this point. Having lived in our houses with masks and social distancing and homeschooling. But when I saw this coming over from China, I saw a great disruptor in the real estate world. Beyond the public health pandemic that was going on, I said to myself, people are going to want to move from the cities to exurban areas and to suburban areas. Exurban meaning you can commute to the city once a week, maybe twice a week max. And suburban, as we know, you'll go 5 days a week. I said, they're going to want to get out of the high rises. And this is going to change the real estate world. And after that, it's going to change even more. So I said, this is an opportunity. And then here's an aside to this whole novel, great idea. My office was closed, so I had a little time on my hands, Bob. So I said to myself, I'm going to use this time and I'm going to write a book that I want to do. And I've always wanted to write a real estate book, and I'm going to tell you why. One of my favorite books growing up was Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Kiyosaki. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was such a brilliant idea that people should learn how to get a passive stream of income as opposed to chasing the dollar their whole life, being in that rat race. I grew up with my parents divorced, with my mother and I struggling because she was a single mother. It was a hard time for a little while. And I said all the time when I read that book, that makes so much sense. But then when you try and implement some of the ideas in a book like that, you go, I don't really know anything. It's a great theory. It's a great idea, but there's no skills. So what I wanted to do was write a book that had skills, tangible things you can walk away with and say, now I can go implement it. So what I did is I put a book together with 10 strategies to show you everything from setting your bottom line all the way to writing your business plan. So you can have this toolkit in your hand and go invest and make money as the market's changing, which, as we've all seen, it's continuing to change.
Natural question becomes for some of the people who are listening to us too. Is this or is this not a good time to get into real estate investing?
Well, it depends what you mean by get into. If we're saying purchasing property, which is what I'm talking about, yeah. I can just tell you from myself, my wife and I have investment property. Last week, we liquidated one of the investment properties. And the reason we're liquidating is we're going cash. And why are we going cash? We believe in 2022, first quarter at the end of it, second quarter, it's going to be prime time to invest. And you can't do real estate like you do stocks, like every day you day trade in, you day trade out, you watch this, you watch that. Real estate is much more of an illiquid asset, meaning it's much harder to get in and get out. So if you're thinking about getting in 6 months, a year from now, which is what I'm suggesting, you should be getting liquid now and saving up those shekels, as we say, so you can go and you can go buy then. And there's a reason why I say that. The reason is, as you know, in New York, we have this eviction moratorium till January 22nd, 2022 for evictions and foreclosures. We don't know if it's going to go even further. And until all those houses from the evictions and the foreclosures flood the market, we're having a supply crisis in New York right now, which has been driving the pricing. I think that's all going to change once we see foreclosures and evictions hit the market.
Are you amazed that this moratorium has extended that length?
Amazed is not anything I am ever with anything that politicians ever do. But I would just say to you to start off as aside, I get calls every day. What do you think they're going to do in this, in that, in this field? You started off by saying I do regulatory work, and we track every statute in the state, every federal statute, the state register, the federal register, those are regulations, every day. And I can tell you that when you expect someone to do something and you make your decisions based on expectations, you will be sadly disappointed. But in good business, you need to know what's coming down the pipes and what's going to happen next. So let's tie back to a clear answer to you. The reason why CDC said they did a moratorium, even though that was overturned by the US Supreme Court, is they explain that when someone gets evicted, they're more likely to move in with friends and family in tighter quarters.
Right.
When people are living in tighter quarters, there's more spread of COVID. So do I think it's a bad idea on a macro policy level to have a moratorium today to protect people, to stop our economy from shutting down? No. So if you say, pose the question like this, Bob, do I think that landlords should be able to evict their tenants? Yes. Do I think that if landlords can't evict their tenants and consequently COVID will stay under control and businesses can stay open, if that's a good idea? I say also yes. To bring you back, you said to me, what would I tell a young law student?
Mm-hmm.
And what did I say? I said to you, there aren't simple answers. Everything's right. Nuanced. And that's my answer to you.
For some people at times may seem confusing that the action was taken because it was in extending the moratorium, because as I understand, it was really the first move by a state that put these barriers to eviction in place after the Supreme Court had rejected the Biden administration's moratorium. That's why some people seem so confused by this.
I'm going to clear that up, because I had a hot dog with my father the other day. And my father said to me, he goes, you need to clear this up. We were having a conversation. And he said, he heard me write about this. And he said to me, and don't worry, we had crowd on the hot dog. You looked a little confused about that. It's very important to have the crowd. And while we were talking, he said to me, the problem is that this actually isn't a moratorium. And I need to get that word out there. Because unlike New York's prior moratorium, where a tenant could unilaterally say that you can't evict me, I've qualified myself. This new New York moratorium says a landlord can say, judge, I want a hearing. I don't believe this person qualifies for the moratorium. And if you pursue the eviction and you say that, one of two things are going to happen. Number one, in the hearing, the judge says they don't qualify. And then the judge lets you evict them. Number two, the judge is going to say, there's this $2.35 billion in rental assistance. Tenant, you're the one that can apply, not the landlord. I'm directing you to go apply and get that rental assistance, a year's worth of rent plus another 3 months, and give it to your landlord. Since they can't evict you, get them paid.
Thank you for that clarification. Very interesting. Father, obviously a very wise man in asking you to do that clarifying too.
But he took my extra hot dog, Bob. I want you to know. And I'm a little salty about this. I had two, then he had two.
Good that you have a good sense of humor.
Thank you.
Dealing with these issues as well too. But I like the way you break this down into a good common sense approach and language that makes it easy for people to understand, because this doesn't have to be everything wrapped up in legalese and be so confusing, does it?
So I would say to you, the number one important thing to being a good lawyer is to understand that your arguments that are all legalese are losers. And what do I mean by that? I think you probably, and most of the people out there, are thinking to themselves, that's good, so you could talk to clients. That's not what I'm saying. Judges hate when you speak like a lawyer. You look like a clown. Tell the judge in the simplest way possible why you're going to win. An elevator pitch. Very simple. I'm evicting them. They're saying they qualify to this moratorium thing. I say they don't. Let's have you decide. You're the judge. That's all we have to do. And when you start getting wrapped up with this self-absorbance of speaking like you have a doctor, which lawyers do, you make a clown of yourself. And it actually loses cases because the simplest way, you know, you got to kiss. Keep it simple, stupid.
All right, let me ask you a couple of questions in this area of housing and real estate. Because some of these things I've heard brought up before. And let's deal with one of these that is a good question for a housing provider, whether it's somebody who's involved as a landlord of a co-op or a condo or an apartment. They have a no pet policy. A resident wants to have an emotional support animal. Where does the law fall in this? Do they have to let the person have this?
I think that of all the topics you could talk about the intersection of real estate and discrimination, this is the best one. And I want to point out, if you didn't notice, I just alluded to it. You have to say, I'm being discriminated against because I have a disability. Mm-hmm. It's not that any Joe or Frank or Sally can say, I want a dog and I'm going to label it an emotional support animal. An emotional support animal is actually a treatment for someone who's been diagnosed by a healthcare provider as needing this emotional support animal. So I want to take it out of the arena that we're all judgmental. And realize for most people that most people that have emotional support animals have post-traumatic stress disorder. And we see a great majority of these people as being military people. Mm-hmm. So the same people that ascribe to support our military make a mockery of their need for an emotional support animal, which is kind of ironic to start off with, but I just need to put that out there. Now to your specific question, a no pet policy doesn't apply to an emotional support animal. Why? It's not a pet. It's a treatment for someone's disability. For example, if you had a rule that said, hey, you can't keep luggage or furniture in the halls in a co-op or a condo, and someone put their walker there, that wouldn't apply. A walker is the same thing as the emotional support animal. So the answer goes like this. If someone has a disability, it's recognized as a disability. That person lets the housing provider, the landlord, the condo, the co-op, lets them know, hey, I need an emotional support animal. If that emotional support animal is necessary for the occupant's equal use and enjoyment of the property, which means that there is a level of this ascribes for this, meaning there is a relationship between the emotional support animal and the ability to have housing. And if that emotional support animal is reasonable, meaning you can't have an emotional support tiger or lion, maybe a bear or mine, but if you do that, then they have to make an accommodation to their rules and policies and allow you to have the emotional support animal, because to deny you the emotional support animal is to deny you housing.
Okay. Now, another question that comes up an awful lot. If somebody is injured on property that someone else owns, can you sue the property owner for your injury?
Almost definitely. And what you should be most noting is that they will most likely have homeowner's insurance if it's a homeowner, or general liability insurance if it's a landlord or other type of occupant of the property. And generally, you won't be collecting from them. People don't understand the difference. You don't sue the insurance company, but you collect from the insurance company. But here's the key. If you don't give an insurance company enough notice that you have an injury, you don't send them an immediate letter from an injury attorney. We do this in my law firm. If you don't say, here's a preservation notice, preserve everything and notify your insurance company. The insurance company could disclaim and say, we're not giving any coverage. And then you got to sue your sister, your friend, the pizza place you go to. And that's not what you want to do. You want the insurance company to make you whole because you were injured from a defective condition on the property. And what a defective condition means is something about that property was dangerous. And it shouldn't have been that way because I don't know about you, but when I go to get my pizza and I put my hand on the counter, I don't like it to flop and hit me right in the face.
Right. Exactly. That would be a little counterproductive, to say the least. I think
they call it a bummer.
Right. Great discussion with Andrew Lieb on our program. Andrew is the managing attorney of Lieb at Law PC, which is on the web at Lieb at Law, LIEBATLAW, that's all is one word, .com. And he's been our guest in this portion of our program, sharing information with us. Also the author of the book, 10 Strategies to Purchase Property Post-Pandemic, The Ultimate Guide to Real Estate Investing. Fun discussion. Thank you so much for joining us on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Go Islanders.
Let's go.